part by a grant from REMAX Realty Associates, currently handling over 30% of the real estate sales transactions in Champaign County. 352-5700. Nobody sells more real estate than REMAX, and they encourage you to join them in supporting public broadcasting. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and Mahomet, providing quality health care to the residents of Central Illinois.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to the program Dr. Stephen Marks. He's a veterinarian. He is, in fact, Associate Professor of Veterinary Clinical Medicine at the U of I and is also Chief of Small Animal Medicine within the College of Vet Medicine, and has been here occasionally to talk with us about the care of companion animals. And as I said before the news, throughout the year, from time to time, we do programs on human medicine. We know people will always have questions about their health and the health of their families. Well, puppies and kitties and the companion animals that live with us are also part of our families, and we know that people have questions about them too. So we think time to time it's also a good opportunity to be able to give you the opportunity to talk with a veterinarian and ask those kinds of questions. So that's what we're doing here this morning. I know that the doctor will take his best shot at answering your question. It's always, doing diagnosis is always difficult over the phone. In fact, when we have doctors here, we say, we can't do that. We hope people will understand there are some limitations, but we think it's good service, and so we're glad to be able to do it. So if you have questions about the animals that live in your house, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good, anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. We'll take as many folks as we can. At any point here, you can give us a call. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Yes, nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I know one of the things that you'd like to mention is the upcoming VetMed open house, and that is just this weekend, right?
It's coming upon us very quickly. It's Saturday, April 3rd, and it runs most of the day at the College of Veterinary Medicine. It's 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. It'll be a wonderful day out for everyone, the family, kids, adults. Things like a petting zoo, and really a tour of a state-of-the-art facility like the Veterinary Teaching Hospital and the only College of Veterinary Medicine in this state, and one of the better schools in the country and probably the world. So worth having a visit.
Sure. So are there any particular things that you'd just like to mention to people that might get them excited about the idea of coming in?
I think for the kids, the petting zoo, for sure. There'll be an amazing assortment of animals that they can touch. There'll be a lot of reptiles out there that they can look at. And then if you're interested in seeing the state of the art of veterinary medical care right now, pretty much we can do anything that can be done in human medicine for the most part to pets. And so touring those facilities, the rehab facility will be up and running, so they'll get to see the underwater treadmill with dogs running on it. It's just a very exciting time, and if you have any interest in animals and veterinary medicine at all, you'll have a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, I have a number of callers here. In fact, the lines are full, and I promise these folks I will get right to you in just a second. But your last comment just prompts the question, is physiologically, are dogs and cats really all that different from human beings?
I mean, in some ways they are, but for the most part, as far as you and I would be concerned, we see the same diseases in both species, and there's a lot of similarities. I mean, there are some species that are more similar. For example, the pig has a very similar cardiovascular system to people, and more similar than the dog. But for the most part, if you have had a disease in your family or a friend, that disease occurs in dogs and cats for the most part.
Okay. It's cancer, heart disease, diabetes.
The same diseases.
Joint complaints.
Absolutely.
All that. Even dementia? You see dementia?
Absolutely. We refer to it as doggy Alzheimer's, but it's the proper name is canine cognitive dysfunction, and it is an old dog disease.
Okay. Well, we have a number of people here who I know would like to ask questions, so we'll get right to it. The first caller is in Urbana, and line number one. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I have a question about a cat. I've got a 16-year-old neutered male house cat. I've had him his entire life. Over the past 2 years, he's lost a great deal of weight. He is severely underweight. He has been twice to a local veterinarian who ran some rather extensive tests on the first visit, and said, well, the cat's in fine health, he's just not eating. He didn't find anything wrong with him with the tests that he did. And suggested that I put him on a high-fat, high-protein food. So the cat now is on the highest fat and protein food I could find, which actually turned out to be a commercial kitten food. So that's what he's eating. However, he's not gaining weight. He's extremely thin, and the veterinarian that I brought him to the two times was concerned about his ability to fight off any sort of disease or anything because he's malnourished. Just wondering if you have any ideas or suggestions for me.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, I don't know all the tests that your veterinarian has done. I mean, the common disorders that you'd want to rule out in an older cat, the typical old cat diseases would be kidney disease or renal failure, which they would have ruled out with blood work.
They did blood work.
Okay, diabetes mellitus would be another disease that could cause weight loss in a kitty. The big disease that hopefully they evaluated for was a disease called hyperthyroidism, which is a very common endocrine disorder in older cats. And if that test has not been done, that would certainly be a test that would be nice and easy to do. It's another blood test. Did you feel your kitty was eating before? I mean, do you think your kitty has been eating normally during this episode of weight loss, or do you think he has not been eating?
He eats approximately most of one of the very small cans of wet food. You know, they come in roughly two sizes.
Right.
Throughout a day, he'll mostly finish a small can of wet food, and he will occasionally nibble a small amount of dry kitten food as well.
Okay. Other things that I would consider would be things like dental disease, which would cause him not to want to eat because of pain. But my biggest concern would be there's different disease processes. If cats are eating and they're eating normally and they're losing weight, then that means that the cat is going through some type of cachectic process, which means the cat is either losing calories somewhere, or the cat is – and those calorie losses could be due to extensive disease like cancer, which would be an older cat disease, or potentially that the cat is not absorbing the food well, which means there's intestinal disease that's prohibiting him, even though he's eating normally, from absorbing the nutrients. And there are additional ways to investigate that. And I would have another conversation with your veterinarian, because if they've not found anything and they've done all the tests you and I have discussed, then the next step is probably referral to a specialty practice like the university, where we can do things like X-ray or ultrasound the abdomen and look for other disease processes that may be continuing to contribute to his weight loss.
All right, very good. I'll make an appointment to talk to my vet to see about the possibility of a referral to the university. Does the amount of food I mentioned, does this seem normal?
That would be an appropriate amount for that kitty to eat, but the question is, he's still losing weight on a high-calorie diet, like a kitten diet. That's concerning. So I wouldn't sit on this too long.
All right. Yeah, it snuck up on us because it was gradual enough that it was one of those things where we looked at him one day and said, "Wow, he's really thin."
Right. That's what happens when you're looking at a pet every day. You're not as objective as potentially someone else may be.
Yeah. All right, then I'll get him back to the vet and take it from there. Thank you.
Well, good luck.
All right, thanks for the call. We'll go next to a caller in Belgium, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I don't have a question about my particular animal. I have a particular question about policy of veterinarians. We have to get a rabies shot every year for our dog to protect from rabies. Mainly, also, I think, keep it registered with the government so they provide dog license. I think it's the main reason for it, because surely you don't need a rabies shot every year.
You raise an incredibly controversial area right now. For the most part, typically in veterinary medicine, we have vaccinated for rabies and the assorted infectious diseases that we see in dogs and cats on an annual basis. And if you compare that with other species, specifically us, that would seem like a little bit of overkill. The problem is right now, veterinary medicine as a whole does not have complete control of vaccination protocols. For infectious diseases, we do. And a lot of veterinarians and veterinary institutions have now recommended the vaccination for the typical infectious diseases other than rabies to be done every other year or potentially every 3 years. Now, the rabies vaccine, there is a rabies vaccine that's marketed for every 3 years. The problem is that rule or law is set by the local jurisdiction, which means state, county, laws may apply. And so it's not necessarily the veterinary profession that set that. So there are people that now – there are states that allow for every 3 years. We just don't happen to be one of those states, or at least in Champaign and Urbana, the recommendation is still vaccinating annually. And that – you may see that change in the near future. So that's a very, very valuable – that's a very valuable bit of information.
The other question I'd like to ask is, why don't we vaccinate cats? Cats get out and become a lot closer contact with animals that have rabies than most dogs do anymore.
Well, that's actually another good point. The recommendation is that cats should be vaccinated for rabies. I mean, a lot of pet owners don't do it because they consider the cat an indoor pet only. Mm. But the veterinary recommendations are to vaccinate both dogs and cats, and in most jurisdictions, that's law.
It's obvious they don't live out in the countryside like I do.
Well, you see, that's
lots of feral cats.
Right, exactly. That's exactly the point.
And so, there's no license requirements for cats either.
Well, that's true, and there's no leash laws. It is a concern, but I think you'll see more moves in that direction to have more control over that population of pets.
Thank you very much, sir.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Just to underscore this, it is the consensus opinion, the recommendation of vets that both cats and dogs should be vaccinated against rabies. It may be the question about the how frequently you repeat that, but not that they be vaccinated at all. That you think that should be?
Well, again, it's not an easy question to answer. The controversy with rabies in cats specifically is there has been a vaccine-associated tumor called vaccine-associated sarcoma. And typically what we've done in the past is we, as a group, veterinarians have vaccinated cats in the scruff of the neck. And if you can imagine, so in between the shoulder blades. Mm-hmm. If you have a tumor there, that's not an easy spot to remove a tumor. And so that has increased the incentive for some pet owners to not vaccinate cats. And certainly we've changed where we vaccinate. So now the recommendation for all vaccinations is to be on the periphery. So, for example, on a distal limb. Some veterinarians are actually vaccinating on the distal tail. So if there is a problem and there is a tumor associated with it, that area can be removed or amputated.
What about this issue, as you say, it is controversial about cats. For people who say, look, this animal is an exclusively indoor animal. It doesn't now. It's possible one day, you know, when you're coming in, the cat will go, psh, you know, want to go outside. But that's – we do not put the cat out. We don't let the cat out. Not only is it not going to come out into contact with other animals, not going to come in contact with other cats, you know, why should we or should we have the cat get rabies shots?
Well, I think, you know, the easiest answer to that is we don't usually anticipate these diseases in our pets. We don't anticipate that the cat runs out the door and gets hit by a car. We don't anticipate that our cat will find a rabid bat in the backyard and play with it the one day it's out. It's a concern because rabies is such a devastating disease to both the animal, because if it's detected, the animal needs to be euthanized. Because it's a devastating death, and then plus it's a zoonotic potential, meaning it's spread to people. If a cat bites someone, and let's just say someone comes in your house and the cat bites someone, then there's concern that if that cat was not vaccinated, even though it's a low possibility, that the person that's been bitten by the cat has been exposed to rabies.
Yeah, okay. Well, very good. We have as our guest here this morning Dr. Stephen Marks. He's professor of veterinary medicine at U of I. He's also the chief of small animal medicine in the College of Veterinary Medicine. And we're taking your questions about care of companion animals. And whatever questions you have, I know he will do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Spring Valley, I believe, is the next caller here, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, I have a question about my prairie dog. I got him long before the whole monkeypox scare thing, and so I know he doesn't have any of that, and he's never been exposed to another prairie dog. But his diet, I'm worried about his diet because I don't know exactly what to feed him. I've bought this specially mixed prairie dog food at our local pet store, but he just doesn't like it. I mean, he picks through it and pulls out peanuts and things that he does like. And so I try and feed him, you know, the peanuts, or he likes lettuce or sprouts. And now it's just his cage smells so bad every day. I'm just wondering if there's something else I can give him that he'd enjoy a little bit more and still not think so bad.
Yeah, the only thing you can do is you can check on the internet and you can check some other pet stores. There's a variety of prairie dog feeds that are out there. I don't specifically I don't specifically work with prairie dogs or exotic species. We do have a veterinarian at the university that you can call. There's an exotic animal service. That's Dr. Julia Whittington, and you can give a call up there, and they may be able to give you some more information. The bottom line is, as close as you can keep to a commercially prepared diet, because that's balanced, you want to.
Okay.
And these guys will almost always eat if they get hungry enough. I mean, obviously, you don't want to put them in under any duress.
Yeah.
But by just adding foods that he likes means that you're taking the normal diet and putting it out of balance, and you need to be very careful about that.
Okay.
Okay?
Thanks a lot.
And he's feeling okay otherwise? I mean, he's acting normally?
He's acting normally. He's, you know, he's still active. It's just because I still try to give him a balance of what I think he would find in the wild somewhat. It's just... His poop is still solid and everything is
good. Just as long as he's feeling well, that's a good sign that you're doing a good job with your nutrition. But I would still look into trying some other diets and making sure they're balanced.
All right.
Okay?
All right.
Thank you. We'll go to Winnebago, line number 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
My problem or question today is about Sheltie. We've had a number of females over the years, and they've all been spayed, and they've all developed a thyroid problem, and they all lose their hair when they get to be over 10 years old, especially the undercoat. So they all end up wearing a coat of some sort, you know, a jacket, and... taking a thyroid pill, and is there any way of preventing the hair loss? Are we giving them too much or too little thyroid? Cytomel is the drug we're using.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Thyroid disease is actually fairly common in the dog, and it's hypothyroidism as compared to the cat, which is a hyperthyroidism. The hair loss is actually a common finding in those diseases. Were a lot of these Shelties related? Do you know? Are they?
Oh no.
So no correlation in the family line
no,
that you know.
None
of.
At all.
Yeah.
Completely individual.
I mean, really, the best thing you can do is again see your veterinarian, and they should monitor the thyroid levels fairly carefully. There is some information that suggests that different thyroid supplements have different potency or bioavailability, and so not only do you need to give the pill. You need to actually monitor serum, which is blood concentrations of the hormone thyroxine, and see what it looks like.
Yeah, we send it over to a lab over in Michigan.
Right, so Michigan State, that's actually one of the best endocrine labs in the country.
Yeah.
If you're continually to have problems with the hair coat, it's possible that there's another disease going on other than just the hypothyroidism. And we do have a department of dermatology at the university, and your veterinarian can refer you to us. And let us have a look, because the hair loss, although consistent with hypothyroidism, it's a possibility that you're seeing something else, that the clinical signs overlap, and it's not just hypothyroidism, and that would be worth looking at.
Okay, except that we've had it in all three dogs consecutively.
Right, that seems a little bit odd, but
yeah.
You know, there's no way of knowing if it's the same disease in all those pets, and all you can do is address it in the pet that you're currently looking at and seeing if we can find another disease other than hypothyroidism.
Yeah, well, it doesn't show up in the males.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It would still be worth, in my opinion, having a dermatologist and potentially one of the endocrinologists in the internal medicine section have a look as well.
Okay, we're up by Rockford.
Well, you know, at least you can have – the minimum you can do is to have your veterinarian or yourself call down, and one of our veterinarians can speak to you, specifically our dermatology department.
Okay. Let's see. I think – oh, and the other thing we do is we feed what is it called, WD?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
And you're using that diet because they've tended to be overweight?
No, he says that's a good – diet for the thyroid.
Yeah, I mean the reason they're suggesting that it's not necessarily the diet that I always use, but it's reasonable. Is that WD is really stands for weight diet, and so it's designed to be a weight loss diet. It's high fiber.
Yeah.
And so dogs with hypothyroidism, because their metabolic rate slows, tend to gain more weight, so they're often put on a weight loss diet. that there may be some better diets for the hair coat than WD. So if you're continuing to have that problem again, it would be worth having your veterinarian give us a buzz and we can sit down and chat.
Well, she eats everybody else's food, too.
Yeah, there you go.
So we have a male Sheltie and a rabbit, and the rabbit and this dog both eat everybody's food.
There you go. Sounds like a happy family.
I don't know. The rabbit eats things with chicken in it and pizza, which is not good for bunny rabbits, I don't think.
Yeah, well, I suspect that rabbit thinks it's in heaven.
She pushes the dogs around a little bit, so...
Sounds like a big rabbit or a small Sheltie.
No, she's a very small rabbit. She just got a bad attitude. Yeah, they do very, very well together.
Well, thank you for your call. Let us know if we can help, because it's easy to have your veterinarian just call down and get a consultation with one of our doctors.
Yeah, we'll do that. It's
okay.
Time for another blood check anyway.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right,
my pleasure.
Thanks for the call. Rabbit with a bad attitude. All right. We'll go to Champagne next. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Marks. Good morning.
Good morning.
Listen, I just moved out from California, and before we moved out, we have three dogs, and one of them started just basically licking himself until he actually started bleeding, and we took him to the vet, and they x-rayed, and they did some tests to make sure it wasn't infected. And the guy said it was basically kind of like a psychological problem.
Okay.
And some licking kind of symptom. And it was right before we left from California. Things were kind of in upheaval. Since we've gotten here, it's gone away, but there's scar tissue. And every so often, he just likes to lick it. And just so that it's just opening up. And I'm just wondering what research is on this. And the other thing is, we really didn't have problems with heartworm out there, and you know, I'm about to get some medicine for that. And if you know of a generic on that, and if there are any other types of infections that they're more susceptible to here than they would be in Southern California.
Okay, that's all good. Those are good questions. What breed of dog is doing the licking?
The mother's a pit bull. The father's a black lab.
Okay. And fairly high-strung dog, excitable, or fairly laid-back dog?
Really laid-back.
And how old?
3 years old, and we've had him since he's been a puppy, and we have the mother, too. And he's just real a real loving dog, and we give him a lot of attention. But, sometimes, I mean, we're students, so sometimes, we're away for most
right.
of the day and stuff like that.
And where is he licking? Which area of the body?
Oh, right where his paw and his arm, right in that area where it's, where it's bendable.
Okay, so about the wrist.
Yeah.
It would be your wrist on the front leg?
The front right.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds like your veterinarians have done a good job. I mean, what it sounds like it could be is behaviorally induced, and we tend to call it an acral. It's A-C-R-A-L, lick granuloma. It may be, again, worthwhile seeing a dermatologist to make sure it's not associated with a food allergy, a change in the environment, but it can be stress-induced, and especially when you're finding that it's somewhat resolved now that this chaos is, a little bit resolved after the move. There are behavioral modification drugs, and they tend to be drugs that you would have heard of, similar like Prozac. They are anti-anxiety drugs, or they're tricyclic antidepressants. If he's continuing to do it, there's two ways to approach this. You can have your veterinarian give us a buzz, and we can chat with them about recommendations. There's specifically the closest animal behaviorist in this region is at Purdue University, and they have a very good consultation service, and they can consult with either you or your veterinarian and make some recommendations. It's ideal to prevent the pet from licking it by bandaging the area, although with some dogs that makes them lick more because they want to play with the bandage. And medical management may be indicated, especially if this is becoming more and more of a problem. So that may be behavioral induced, and it's not uncommon to see. But it's not life-threatening. It's just a little bit annoying. The other diseases you're talking about are more concerning. I mean, did you have your pets on heartworm prevention in Southern California?
No, we didn't.
Okay. Because really, Southern California has mosquitoes, and heartworm disease is still a concern. So the first thing to do is have your pets tested for heartworm disease.
Okay.
And the problem is right now is there is no generic for any of the heartworm medications that are on the market. So you're going to spend a bit of money. the best options out there, and it depends on your lifestyle, are the either once-a-month tablets or now there's a twice-a-year injection. My bias is to go for the once-a-month tablets, either HeartGuard, and HeartGuard is the one that I use. It's got a chewable. There's also Interceptor, ProHeart. Those are all slightly different chemicals to prevent heartworm disease in these pets. As far as other preventable diseases in this region of the country, there's not any other chronic medications your pets need to be on. Heartworm would be the big one.
Okay.
But if you have any other questions, you know, feel free to give me a buzz at the university and we can sit down and talk about this in more depth.
All right. Thank
okay?
you very much.
My
all
pleasure.
Right, thanks Bye-bye. For the call. So just if all dogs you should be treated, have that preventive treatment for the heartworm?
It's my recommendation. I mean, if you're in an area that has mosquitoes, then heartworm disease is a concern. And because it is basically 100% preventable with the products that are on the market. And if you're unfortunate enough to get a pet that has heartworm disease, either a dog or a cat, it is a life-threatening disease. Hmm.
And that's something that it requires regular treatment every year, or if in the case of the injections, you'd say every 2 years?
Well, actually, the injection is twice a year right now,
oh,
and that's still an injection. And, you know, I can just tell you, my golden retriever sucks down the once-a-month tablets because they're beef-flavored and they're chewable. There's still a daily, which is more of a nuisance to do, but at a minimum, I would go with the monthly chewable tablet, which dogs seem to enjoy.
Okay. The next caller here, it should be line number 2, and in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to revisit a little bit the vaccine issue because I have some specific concerns about one of my dogs.
Okay.
I have a Chihuahua. He's not particularly fond of veterinarians.
That's a surprise, right?
Yeah. I minimize his exposure to veterinarians as much as possible so that when we do need to go in there, he, you know, hopefully is a little bit calmer.
Right.
He also... The very first time he received a combination shot, had a reaction of some sort, wasn't able to walk for about 3 days.
Okay.
It seemed to be not neurological, but pain-related.
Okay.
So the second year we gave him a shot, we eliminated the lepto.
Okay.
And gave him a shot of Benadryl.
Okay.
About 15 minutes prior to the vaccine.
Good.
And that took care of that problem. But I didn't like the idea of giving him 2 shots, again, more because of the exposure to the veterinarian and trying to keep his attitude positive about
right,
the vet.
Right.
So I'd like to minimize as much as possible shots, but here's the third part of the puzzle is that I compete with him in agility and fly ball so that he has more exposure to diseases
correct, okay.
than the average pet. And okay. so I'm just wondering what to do. I mean, should I just say, okay, you know, the part of your life is a shot of Benadryl and a Cabo shot every year, and that's just the way it is? Or are there, I've heard about doing titer checks, but again, you're puncturing and drawing blood, and I don't know how accurate they are.
Right. Well, you raise very valuable concerns, and I guess the easy answer is, when you have a pet that doesn't enjoy going to the veterinarian, that puts you in a different category of pet owner because those are concerning things, and that's unlikely to get easier unless we find a way to allow him to enjoy that visit a little bit more. One easy thing that can be done, and you can do this in conjunction with your veterinarian, would be to pre-med him with the Benadryl orally before
okay.
you go to the veterinary office, because that can be easily done.
Okay.
It would have to be probably at least an hour before.
Okay.
And that would probably have the same effect as the injectable. The idea of the injection is it works right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be one option.
Okay.
Realistically, there's good information out there to tell us that the vaccines protect for 3 to 5 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But it's a risk. You know, it's a risk
right.
benefit that you have to look at. And if your dog is continually exposed and you go every 3 years and I tell you it's okay and then your dog gets one of the infectious diseases that you potentially were protected or you thought you were protected, then you're going to have a problem.
Right.
So right now the recommendation is for high-risk dogs potentially still going yearly.
Okay.
The titers right now, that's a very, very good question. I don't have an answer for you. The recommendation right now is to not do titers, and that is because every lab that does titers has different normal ranges, and it's really hard to compare them. And because you have a titer, what that means, the titer, just for people that are listening, is it basically measures the concentration of antibodies you have to a disease. So if you had mumps when you were a kid, they could do a titer and say, yep, you have antibodies. That does not necessarily guarantee protection, and that's the problem we have. Is,
okay.
So if your dog has measurable antibodies to distemper, does that mean that he's protected against distemper? We don't know.
Okay.
So those are very good questions.
Okay, I'll just continue as I have and look into the oral Benadryl.
Yeah, and again, if we can answer any more questions, especially with vaccinology, since that's a rapidly changing field, just give us a shout at the university.
Okay. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the call. Let me just introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Dr. Stephen Marks. He's a veterinarian. He's chief of small animal medicine in the U of I College of Vet Medicine. And has been good enough to come here a number of times to answer these kind of questions. And we're really pleased that we have so many and we can do that. We think it's a good service that we can do to give you the opportunity to talk with him and get a little more information on the health of your companion animals. And, of course, if you really have a serious problem, you want to pursue that with your vet, the vet who can see the animal. But this is a good resource and a place that you can start. So whatever questions you have, I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We'll just keep on, and our next caller is in Charleston on line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I have a six-year-old mixed-breed dog who can't put any weight on his right rear leg. Been going on for several weeks. My vet tells me that he may have a torn cruciate ligament, I believe it's called, in the knee. And I understand there's surgery possible for this. And I wondered what the success rate of such surgery might be and whether he's just likely to go out and injure it again, since I do run him free sometimes.
Okay, that's a good question. And it sounds like your veterinarian has provided you with a diagnosis. So it's a cruciate ligament, and the cruciate's because it's basically two ligaments that cross and look like an X, and it's a very common athletic injury in people, and certainly it's a very common injury in dogs. It's one of the surgeries out there that there's somewhat a bit of controversy. There's a lot of different ways to surgically repair that injury. Right now, the state of the art is something called a TPLO. It's a very specific orthopedic procedure that not all veterinarians can do, but there are other ways of doing it that other veterinarians can do. If you want to do the TPLO, and that's tibial plateau leveling osteotomy, that can only be done in this city at the university. I would say they have very, very good success with it. A little bit it depends upon how chronic the injury is. So if the pet has some degenerative joint disease or arthritis already occurring in that joint, which hopefully you don't, if you have that type of disease already present, then the prognosis is worse. But it's probably best to have that looked at and consider repair, because the repair will return the dog to almost normal function. And if you don't repair it, then chronic osteoarthritis is a very common sequela. And the pet will never have full use of that limb, and that's a concern. Now, this is assuming it's a cruciate, and it's not a patellar injury, or it's not a hip injury, or it's not a muscle injury. So I can't tell you that over the phone, but it would be at least worth having a consultation with one of the orthopedic surgeons at the U of I, and that can be done either by yourself or by your veterinarian. I mean, we at the U of I, we work best working as a team with your veterinarian and you. I mean, that's what we're here for, is specialists to help general practitioners in the area provide better care for their pets.
Is this kind of surgery fairly costly?
It is, unfortunately. That's the other side of it. I mean, for most orthopedic procedures, you're looking up, over $1,000, potentially $1,500 to $2,000 for that type of injury. Now, that's at the university. It's a possibility that there's some other general practitioners that would not do the specific procedure I'm talking about, but another procedure and be able to do it for less financial investment. How much does your dog weigh?
Oh, about 50 pounds.
Okay, so he would be suitable at size for several different techniques. But I would still get as much information as you can by talking to your veterinarian and talking to orthopedic surgeons at the U of I, and at least look at all your options and get specific prices for each of the procedures.
Okay, thank you.
My pleasure.
Right, on to Marseilles, line three. Hello.
Mm-hmm. Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a little Lhasa Apso, and I put him on leash and walk around the yard, and the last few months we've had deer in the yard at night, and he is on allergies for outside allergies. And we've never used the Lyme. Is it the Lyme vaccination? Isn't there a certain vaccination
yes.
if you're around deer?
Yes.
Would you suggest that I contact my vet on that?
I guess I would at least contact them. I mean, there's a very specific tick, and it's a specific type of deer tick that spreads that disease, and the disease is borreliosis, mm-hmm. and generically called Lyme disease from Lyme County on the East Coast where it was first identified.
Okay.
It is potentially a concern for both you and your dog.
We took a tick off of him last night. That's what I'm a little concerned. It was like a flesh-bodied tick right above the eye.
Okay.
And is that the kind of tick?
Well, it's going to be hard for me to tell from that description. That, uh-huh. If you can save the tick, I don't know if you already flushed it or you...
Yeah, we got rid of it.
Yes. if you see other ticks, it might be worth bringing them to your veterinarian. Try not to handle them. Uh-huh. Just put them in some type of container, and your veterinarian can either identify it or send it over to the U of I for identification. But if you really think there's a large number of ticks, I would consult with your veterinarian and see if they think they're seeing a higher incidence of Lyme disease. That vaccine is not usually recommended unless your pet is at high risk.
Right, that's what I was told before.
You know, and it would be worth talking to your veterinarian and see if they're seeing any increased incidence of borreliosis in your area.
Okay. Another thing that I have been down there with my dog quite, and my other Lhasa that I had too, and I just can't praise the University of Illinois enough, the vet clinic. Everybody is so friendly and nice and helpful to you. And I did go down with my dog's attitude problem, and it is sort of an aggressive attitude toward a person or whatever he will pick out, whether at home or in someone else's house, yeah, because I do have a dog sitter when we're traveling. And his last incident, I always tell everybody to ignore the dog, and I've had a gal come 7 different times, and she said he's just aggressive, and he will pick a certain person, and he barks up their leg rather viciously, and I think he would bite them if he could get a hold of them. And then he will turn on the caretaker because he's still in that aggressive state, and we do kennel him. And I've done a lot of reading. I've read books where they say don't put the dog in the down position where you put him on his side until he's calmed down. She said probably you will get bit. I just wondered your opinion, because the last incident where the person just said, "Hi, Casey," and he went up the leg after this one particular person, not the other person, and then he turned on the caregiver. And this vet tech told me to put him in the down position and establish the dominance. And can that be me? I wouldn't never ask a person who he went up against to do that, but would that be your suggestion?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to answer without seeing the pet and seeing the actual activity. But the directed or misdirected aggression is not that uncommon, meaning that if he goes for one person and then in that same time interval he's redirected towards the caregiver, that's not that uncommon.
Right.
Unfortunately, you in a pet like this, what you're likely to have to do is do both behavioral modification training as well as medication. And again, this is a huge pool of information gathering that's animal behavior. And my recommendation is actually to get a consult with an animal behaviorist.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the closest one that we utilize is the department at the University of Purdue or Purdue University.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's very specific therapies, both drug-wise, but more importantly, there's just a limited number of drugs we can use. And drugs only work on their own in probably about less than 25% of cases.
Uh-huh.
So it potentially means you working with the person that's handling the dog, so the caregiver when you're out of town, and doing some very specific activities to condition the dog so we don't see this aggression. And it's honestly, it's difficult.
Yeah, I thought it was, because it's not everyone, and you never know when it's going to happen. So if everybody just totally ignores him and doesn't say anything to him, he never fires up on anybody.
Right.
But if somebody gives him attention and he decides to go for him, and it's I can manage him that way, but it's trying to manage the people that's difficult,
right,
too.
And I agree. And people tend to be a little bit put off and frightened. It would at least be worth a call over to animal behaviorists to just touch base and let them know, because these are things that can potentially be done via consultation.
Okay. And I want to praise your you had a call from someone, I think, from Rockford with the hair loss and the thyroid problem.
Yes, ma'am.
And I was down there with my first Lhasa who had a lot of hair loss, and they diagnosed, Dr. Kevin Byrne diagnosed him with a superficial, I think called neolytic dermatitis, SND,
right.
And he had a lot of hair loss, and I just can't praise them enough for finding that this dog did have that, And we kept the dog alive 2.5 years due to the University of Illinois and then our diligence in going down there. So if the person from Rockford is listening, it's well worth the trip.
That's nice of you to say, and we appreciate your support. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We have about 15 minutes left. Again, our guest is Dr. Stephen Marks. He's chief of small animal medicine in the U of I College of Vet Medicine. Questions are certainly welcome. We talked with as many people as we possibly can. The number here, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that we can take your calls, or we'll be happy to pay for the calls, but it would be a long-distance call for you. One thing we want to mention real quick, I want to make sure I give you the chance to do that before we end up out of time. We talked a little bit at the beginning about the VetMed open house, but this is another event that you have going that's specifically intended to raise money for the wildlife clinic that you have. And I don't know if people really recognize that in addition to providing care for all kinds of domestic animals, livestock and dogs and cats, that you also have a clinic there where you specialize in trying to help injured wild animals. And we're talking about raptors and I don't know what all else.
Well, it's actually a very exciting area at the U of I, and it's basically the Wildlife Clinic, which is a nonprofit group, and we do take care of all wildlife, although we tend to see a lot of raptors. That's probably our main patient, but any wildlife that we can help and get rehabbed back into the environment is there's lots of doctors that work in this area and lots of students, and it's a very exciting area. It's a volunteer student organization, so they pretty much run the show. They get great experience. These are incredible animals, and they belong in the wild, so we try and do everything we can to return them to the wild. The celebrity doodle auction is something that's been done for the last couple of years, and basically it raises funds and it raises awareness for wildlife. We solicit doodles or drawings from celebrities, and it's amazing how many celebrities want to support this type of endeavor. Mm-hmm. And then there's a silent auction and an open auction. It's actually April 17th. So in a couple of Saturdays from now, it's at 6 p.m. at the High Dive Club in downtown Champaign. There'll be hors d'oeuvres. There'll be a cash bar, $25 a ticket in advance. And there's information on the U of I College of Vet Med website, or you can call the College of Veterinary Medicine. Just to give you an idea of some of the things that are out there, I mean, we have amazing celebrities send things. If you're a baseball fan, Yogi Berra. If you're a movie star fan, there's lots of people that send in cool drawings. There'll be entertainment that evening. There's other things on the auction block, like a behind-the-scene tour at the Brookfield Zoo or the Shedd Aquarium. I can tell you last year I purchased a day at the Willard Airport with the fire and rescue crew, which I took my 4-year-old boy and five of his closest friends, and we got to ride on a fire truck up and down. And actually, the fathers had a better time than the sons. So there's amazing things, and really it is for a good cause. And so it's the College of Veterinary Medicine celebrity doodle auction, and it raises funds and the awareness of wildlife and supports the wildlife clinic.
Okay, that's April 17th.
April 17th at the High Dive in downtown Champaign.
Okay. And then this weekend is the Vet Med.
This weekend, April 3rd, Saturday, most of the day, 9 to 4 p.m., free parking, free admission. It's a great day out for everybody.
Okay, very good. Well, let's get back here to talking with some people here. And next is Savoy, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I'm thinking about raising a baby wallaby as a household pet and also a penguin. Do you have any opinions or recommendations?
I'll tell you, there's a lot of things I can talk about, but wallabies and penguins would not be on the list. My recommendation, my personal opinion is I think you have to be careful about taking alternative pets into the household without getting a lot of information and knowing the laws within the state and what you're getting yourself into. Your best bet there would be to call there's two people that I know of you can call right now. It would be Dr. Julia Whittington at the university, and she's actually the head of the Exotic Service and the Wildlife Clinic. The other resource which would potentially be more valuable with this species that you're talking about would be to call the Brookfield Zoo.
Okay.
And there's a Dr. Langdon there, Jennifer Langdon. And
okay.
She actually has an adjunct appointment in our section at the university. And I would get some more information about what you're getting yourself into.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. My pleasure.
All right. Let's go to Champaign next, line two. Hello.
Good, Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have two questions. I have an 11-year-old female golden retriever, and we have for a long time watched a small lump grow on her abdomen, and her local vet really has not been too concerned by it. It's not preventing her from taking walks or anything else, but it's now probably about the size of a softball, and we continue to get more concerned by it. The other thing is, at 11 years old, her activity has seemed to diminish quite a bit as far as we've always walked her probably 1 to 2 miles a day, and now she probably could care less if she walks much more than around the block. So those are the two questions I have, and I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
Okay. Would you like to call her to hold on? Do you want to be able to ask any follow-ups?
You can stay on the line because
okay,
I may ask you a couple. Is she still eating and drinking normally?
Perfectly.
And her mentation as far as how she interacts with you and your family members, everything else is the same?
The same.
Okay. So nothing has changed other than you think her activity has decreased.
Right. And I didn't know if that's due to the age. And then with the lump, it's just continued to grow. She doesn't seem to even notice it.
Can you describe what the lump feels like? Is it just kind of soft and
no,
or is it
hard.
Firm?
It's okay. Firm.
I mean, I can tell you that I have a pretty strong bias in older pets. I personally would investigate that.
Okay.
There's several ways to do that. It may be nothing, and your veterinarian may be absolutely right. But I guess I like to know.
Okay.
And so one of the easy ways to evaluate that is to put it's called a fine needle aspirate, and a veterinarian can put a fine needle, so a thin needle, and aspirate or suck on that syringe and actually look at the cells and see if they can tell what it is.
Okay.
And there's a little bit of a misnomer. We say, well, it's not bothering the pet now, and we wait till it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it becomes more of a problem to address. And then if the pet is not feeling quite so well, when you do decide it's a problem, then potentially we're putting that pet at risk to do anything. So when she's still feeling pretty good, in my opinion, would be the time to investigate it. And if it's nothing, then it's nothing and you'll be done with it. If it's something, then at least you've addressed it sooner than you would have.
Okay.
That would be number one. Number two would be, it could be age. I mean, it could be an 11-year-old golden retriever slowing down. I mean, she may have some osteoarthritis. She may have some hip pain, some joint pain. Or it may be a sign of systemic disease, and it's just subtly slowing her down. So again, if your veterinarian has not done a geriatric evaluation, meaning a physical exam,
right,
and some common laboratory tests, that should be considered.
Okay.
I mean, my opinion is that to just look at a healthy dog and say the dog's healthy when they're old can be done, but we have some more sensitive and specific tests that we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, other than the finance, it's a no-lose proposition, because if you get good news that there's nothing going on,
right,
you can rest easy. And if you unfortunately get bad news, at least you know and you have some time to address it.
So not necessarily just because she's 11, she should be starting to slow down.
Well, I'll tell you, old age is not a disease.
Okay.
Right? And so, yes, older dogs will slow down, but it's not uncommon for us to see pets that have a disease and we treat it and the pet responds and
okay,
the owners say, you know, she's so much better, she's acting like a puppy, and we just thought she was getting old.
Okay. And with the aspiration, how long does it take to get the results, and does the dog go through much pain?
No. It's, and in fact, if this is the typical 11-year-old golden retriever that I see, she'll probably wag her tail while they're doing the procedure.
Okay.
It depends upon if your veterinarian reads cytology in
okay,
the practice, or they're sending it over to the U of I to be read.
Okay.
And there's no guarantee that you'll get an answer. That's the first step. If you don't get an answer off that, the choice would be to either take a biopsy or just say, let's go full guns and remove it and find out what it is based on that.
Okay.
Okay?
Great. Thank you, Dr.
My pleasure.
Right, thanks for the call. Next, we have somebody on a cell phone, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
My question is about the flea medications, that, like the Advantage, that type of thing that you're supposed to put on cats. And I have a kitty cat who is about 8 years old, and I used to live in an apartment where I never had any concerns about her getting anywhere near fleas, so I never put anything on her. Then we moved into a house where she can sit in the windows, and, you know, it's possible for her to run outside. So I went to the vet and got some topical applications of I think it's Advantage, and she reacted terribly to it. She would go, just as soon as we would put it on, she would start just complaining out. She was loud, and she would go run under the bed. And then for 2 days, she would just hide under the bed and not want to come out and kind of make a panting sort of noise, and so I'm concerned. I haven't used it again. I tried it on her twice, thinking that maybe, I thought maybe she didn't like the smell, because it has kind of that, I don't know, kind of a gasoline type of smell.
Right, right.
Or ammonia smell. So I haven't put it on her again, and I'm just, you know, I'm concerned about the possibility of getting fleas and fleas in the house, and
right.
I don't know, it's been 2 years since I've tried it. Has there, I guess, is there a possibility that she was having some type of skin reaction, or are there any better type of medications that are out there now?
Yeah, there's, I'll tell you, that's one of the more rapidly growing areas of therapeutics and veterinary medicine, so it's worth visiting with your veterinarian and sitting down and chatting with them as far as what products will work best. Advantage and Frontline are the two biggies. We're using the drop. Were you just using a drop that you put behind the kitty's neck with the Advantage, or
right,
are you spraying
exactly.
it on?
That's what I would use, the drop between
okay.
her shoulder blades,
yeah.
and she hated it.
Yeah, I mean, those are systemic signs, so it, meaning that she's running around and it sounds like she's panting or open-mouth breathing, and that would concern me. So I potentially would not use that product again without seeing a veterinarian. And again,
okay.
There's so many products out there right now, it would at least be worth a shot to change to another product and see how you do. But I would not go back and use the Advantage right now.
Okay, yeah, I had gotten 3 applications at the time. Like I said, it was a while ago, and after twice, I threw it away.
I think that was probably smart, but there's a lot of products out there, and it'd be worth at least trying one of the others, because that is the best way to keep your household and your pet free from fleas.
Okay, great. Well,
okay.
I'll go back to the vet and try something else.
Yeah, and if you have problems, again, just give us a call, because we're glad to consult on those issues as well.
Okay, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, well, you know, we're going to have to stop, and I'm sorry we have a couple of callers we can't take, but I certainly appreciate you coming and giving us your time. And maybe a couple of months in the summer, you can come back and we'll do it again.
We're glad to, and you know, we're always available at the university, so if the callers that are online have, you know, burning questions, just give me a buzz at the university and ask for me, and we're glad to help. And, you know, we love pets as much as you do, so we like doing what we do, and we're happy to help the community.
Very good. Dr. Stephen Marks, he's Chief of Small Animal Medicine at the College of Vet Medicine here at the U of I. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Our show, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Programming also made possible by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Coming up a little bit later today, the Afternoon Magazine. In fact, the show starts at noon. Sitting in today as host is Jay Pierce. They'll have the usual mix of news and weather and sports and other things. Also, in the 1 o'clock hour, we will have a tribute to Alistair Cook, the longtime BBC commentator who died yesterday, produced by the BBC. And after that, we'll open up the phone lines. Jay Pierce will host an open line. People can call in and express their appreciation for the contributions of Alistair Cook. So that's today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. The show itself gets underway at noon. Right now, I'm going to take a break. We'll have news and an update on the markets.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists, on the web at a6395.com and at agrigold.com.
And with this commodity market update, I'm Tom Rogers. The planning reports and stocks report.